What are the realities on the ground affecting the people in Syria? Are the people of Aleppo threatened more by the Syrian airstrikes or by the militant opposition factions on the ground? Could mainstream Western media and human rights bodies like Médecins Sans Frontières and Amnesty International be deceiving the world about the human rights situation throughout Syria? Is there a Syrian civil war pitting a popular internal resistance against a brutal despotic government, or is this an invasion in disguise? What are the true aims behind US-NATO efforts to delegitimize President Bashar al-Assad? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we hear an extensive interview with Canadian writer and independent journalist Ava Bartlett about her reporting from Syria and about the media's distortion of the situation there. Then we speak to Stephen Gowans, Ottawa-based author of a new book on the Syrian conflict. He debunks misconceptions about a popular resistance in Syria and about the West's true aims in the region. On this week's program, what's really going on in Syria? Conversations with Ava Bartlett and Stephen Gowans. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 13th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. CIA was bluffing, produced no evidence. Russians did not hack the election. Is this the beginning of the end of the deep state in the USA? Can Trump clean house and wage peace? Aided by enormous restraint on the part of Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, the soft coup in the USA has collapsed. Not only has the US intelligence community lost all semblance of credibility with incoming President Donald Trump, but the blackmail by the Central Intelligence Agency of Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham has been revealed by investigative journalist Wayne Madsen. That comes from the article, "The Soft Coup Collapses, CIA Bluffing, Russia Did Not Hack, Blackmail Revealed, What Next?" by Robert David Steele, posted January 9th. With so much power and authority, like those attributed to top intelligence agencies proclaiming that President Putin directed cyber attacks against fair and democratic U.S. election, who would not believe it? That's heavy stuff. You would think that such agencies must have serious sources and made serious analyses to come unanimously to the same results. Russia is guilty. It makes you forget, or at best confused, in the light of their conclusion to the contrary before. So, all the doubters around the globe, reset your thinking. The CIA says so, and they are most likely helped by their pal in crime, Mossad. But that nobody is supposed to know. That comes from the article, "Russian Cyber Attacking, When the Most Flagrant Lie Becomes the Truth," by Peter Koenig, posted January 10th. Trump nominated Steven Mnuchin, a 17-year veteran of Goldman Sachs, to be his Treasury Secretary. Stephen Bannon, another former Goldman Sachs banker, was named by Trump as his chief strategist in the White House. The sitting president of Goldman Sachs, Gary Cohn, has been named by Trump as director of the National Economic Council, which, according to its website, coordinates policymaking for domestic and international economic issues. Last week, in a move that stunned even Wall Street, Trump nominated a Goldman Sachs outside lawyer, Jay Clayton, of Sullivan and Cromwell, to serve as Wall Street's top cop as chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Adding to the slap in the face to Trump's working class supporters, Clayton's wife currently works as a vice president at Goldman Sachs. That comes from the article, "Here's How Goldman Sachs Became the Overlord of the Trump Administration," by Pam Martins and Russ Martins, posted January 10th, originally appearing at Wall Street on Parade. It was Secretary of State Kissinger who asked his good friend David Rockefeller to facilitate Nixon's China opening to the West in 1971. Then, the geopolitical aim of Kissinger's rebalance was to seduce China, then the weaker of Washington's two great adversaries, into the Western alliance against the Soviet Union, then the stronger adversary, at least in military and geopolitical terms. Today, as the year 2017 begins, the roles have turned, and clearly China has emerged after more than three decades of unbridled industrial and economic expansion as the stronger challenger of David Rockefeller's so-called world government. Russia, following the economic savagery and deindustrialization of the post-1991 Yeltsin years, is, in Kissinger's view, clearly the weaker of his two adversaries. Both China and Russia, under Xi Jinping and Putin, are, together with Iran, the most formidable defenders of national sovereignty, the main obstacles standing in the way of David Rockefeller's, I use him as the template, world fascist government. That comes from the article, Billionaires to Key Cabinet Ministers. Is Donald Trump the backdoor man for Henry A. Kissinger and Company? By F. William Engdahl, posted January 10th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. Since 1953, Cuba has been and continues to be the quintessence of cultivating ideological principles. Every written and spoken word of Fidel is impregnated with ideology. It is not stagnant. On the contrary, it is continuously evolving according to the context. Otherwise, Cuba would not have been able to outlast its enemies all this time. I am convinced that one of the main implicit objectives of the international corporate media campaign against the persona of Fidel right after his passing was imperialism's revenge against him for not capitulating on ideology. That comes from the article, The End of Ideology in Cuba, by Arnold August, posted January 10th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Ava Corrine Bartlett is an independent Canadian journalist, writer, and rights activist who has done extensive reporting from Gaza and has documented the Israeli bombing campaigns on that territory while riding in ambulances and reporting from hospitals. She's visited Syria six times since April of 2014 and was in Aleppo twice, including during the month of November. She's about to embark on a tour of Canadian cities to share her understanding of the conflict in that country, which wildly contradicts mainstream Western media narratives. Well, being this the show this is, we just had to bring her on to enlighten us about her viewpoints. So, Eva Bartlett, thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor. I have a lot of respect for the authors and people who contribute to Global Research. Oh. I will just note, point. I've actually been in Aleppo four times, and I only mention that because it is relevant in terms of combating the lies that the media have been saying about Aleppo.
Okay, well, thank you for that clarification. So first off, I just wanted to give you a chance to maybe give us a little bit more detail about your background, help share an understanding of who you are to our audience. I mean, you say, I think that you've stated that there other than two international delegations that you participated in Syria, you were financed on your own dime for the others. And you're not making a lot of money with this kind of reporting. So what exactly motivated you in the first place to take on the task of reporting from these war-torn regions?
It's the same kind of drive that drove me to go to occupied Palestine in the first place, because basically my entire adult life until my late 20s, I was completely politically unaware and naive. And then just by happenstance, when I was teaching English in South Korea, I came across online media that was talking about what was happening in Palestine, and I was shocked. And I mean, that's how naive I was. And I think it's good for people to know that, because there's a reason, I believe, that I wasn't informed on many issues, and that is what we're going to be talking about today, and that's the media and what the media allows us to know or to be concerned about. So in around 2007, I first went to Occupied Palestine. And this is all, you know, documented, or it's public knowledge. So anyway, I spent about 8 months in the Occupied West Bank volunteering and seeing, you know, awful atrocities committed by the Israelis against the Palestinians. And later I sailed to Gaza from Cyprus and spent a collective 3 years there, documenting not only the Zionist crimes against Palestinians when they commit massacres against Palestinians, but also the daily crimes of, you know, imposing a brutal siege on the people of Gaza, and also firing at farmers and fishers when they just simply try to eke out a living. So when things started in Syria, I had absolutely no knowledge about Syria, no prior ideas, but I was aware of what had, you know, what was happening in Libya, the crimes against the people of Libya and Gaddafi, and what had happened, obviously, to the people of Iraq, all by the same NATO alliance. And so I started paying attention to independent media like Global Research and other sites and started trying to get informed. I was still living in Gaza until about March 2013, and when I did come back to Canada, then I started talking with Syrians in Canada and trying to get their perspective on things. And then, as you mentioned, one of the two delegations I joined to go to Syria, the very first time I went to Syria in April 2014, was with an international delegation of concerned rights activists who wanted to go in solidarity, but also to, you know, be in Syria and meet with people and get their perspective on what was happening. So that was the introduction to my continued visits to Syria. And as you mentioned, except for the two delegations, I've gone independently, I've gotten the visa on my own, waited extended periods to get that visa, and then, you know, taken a shared taxi from Beirut to Damascus, and then arranged things on my own from within Syria. So I guess that context is important because we'll probably touch on this, but there's been some media campaigns against people like myself, not exclusively against me, but essentially against people who the media is now dubbing fake news, who dare to contradict the corporate narrative on what's happening in Syria. And one of the slander campaigns has been because of all the publications, including mostly non-paid, that I contribute. I also have contributed a total of 8 op-eds to Russia Today. Some people who want to try to discredit what I'm sharing, which is the voices of Syrians I've encountered on these 6 visits, including extensive travel, you know, 2 months this summer and a month in October, November, as well as prior visits. These smear campaigns are trying to discredit the voices that I'm simply trying to transmit to people by calling me a Russian agent simply because I've contributed 8 op-eds to RT. So long answer. basically, you know, it's devastating what's happened to the people of Syria, and our media, aside from the good independent alternative media like Global Research and others, our media has been a shamefully complicit vehicle to transmit war propaganda and confuse people on what's really happening in Syria.
Ava, do you think you could maybe, like, I'm sure you did your research in advance of going down there, but I am curious to know what your impressions of the Syrian people were when you got there. I mean, I imagine for a lot of Canadians, maybe not necessarily the listeners of this program, but, you know, may just have a kind of an idea, largely fostered by the media, I suspect, of these Syrians as these poor, underprivileged people, victims of fate, you know, under this dictatorial government, and they're in this Islamic country, and this, us compassionate Canadians have an obligation to allow all those refugees to come to this country and shower our compassion on them and use principled leadership at the UN. Does that depiction coincide with your understanding, having been there?
That made me laugh out loud because that is a depiction of the corporate media and so-called human rights groups and Western leadership. And when you go to Syria, you find overall a largely educated people, because you have to bear in mind, unlike our system, education is free there and people obtain high degrees of higher education. You find people, it's a very secular society. So our media paints everything that's happening in Syria as a sectarian war, but you go to Syria, and Syrians, you can find Sunni Muslim women unveiled and beautiful, and, you know, in the present, you know, mixing with you know, it's not sectarian, basically. You find them mixing with Christians, with Shia, with whatever, Alawi, and they define themselves as Syrian, and they're proudly defiant. They, I mean, overwhelmingly, this is not to say everybody supports President Assad, but overwhelmingly they do. And when I say this again, just like people have tried to paint me as a Russian agent, then people will say, well, she's an Assad propagandist. Look, go to Syria and decide for yourself. You can go to these so-called rebel areas and you'll find a different sentiment, but these are by and large the minority. You go to Damascus, Homs, Aleppo, like I have, to various other areas, and you'll find that people support him, some to the degree that they actually love him and wear T-shirts with his image on it, others because they believe him to be a unifying force. But certainly, above all, they don't see him as the issue in Syria. They are, I mean, again, when things started in 2011, I wasn't there, but I have talked with many people who even participated in protests. And they weren't participating against Assad. They were participating for political changes. And this is what they've told me. And many of these people that I've met that had participated in protests, they said from very early on, they realized something was wrong. These weren't protests for political change. These were empty slogans. These were slogans including kill the Alawis and drive Christians into Lebanon. And, you know, people who did participate in this protest, many of them, even at the time, might have had feelings against Assad. I know somebody, a dear friend from Ma'loula, who for no particular reason didn't particularly like Assad. But over the years, he's come to realize that, in fact, President Assad's handling the situation in Syria with incredible, anyway, he's changed his views and he sees that he supports Assad. And by and large, the sentiment you'll get there is that this is not about Assad. This is about the mercenaries, the terrorists that have invaded our country, that are slaughtering and beheading and mutilating our people and destroying our heritage. Okay. So and the other thing you hit on is no, it's not Syrians, just like it's not in Palestine. It's not these people saying, please help us, please UN give us aid. In both situations, they're saying stop the violence against us. That's all they want. They're a very, you know, dignified people, very resourceful people. They don't want NGOs. They don't want these Save Aleppo campaigns. They want, and thankfully, Aleppo is now liberated. But what they wanted all these years is just to stop the terrorists from sending bombs onto them or besieging them. And this is the same in other areas that are still besieged, like Fou and Kafraya. You know, when we talk about the UN, the UN has been a large part in obfuscating the reality what's happening in Syria. For example, earlier this year, if I may go on, we're in 2017 now. At the beginning of 2016, there was a sudden overnight campaign of Save Madaya, and everybody, all the media were talking about Madaya, and there was Facebook campaigns about Madaya. Nobody at that time, including the UN, was talking about Fou and Kafraya. Fou and Kafraya are two villages in Idlib in western Syria that have been fully besieged since March 2015. And the United Nations, even in March 2015, when the siege came into place by these different so-called rebel factions, including Ahrar al-Sham and al-Nusra, when the siege was fully in place on Fou and Kafraya, United Nations expressed, you know, their usual grave concern, and then basically said nothing about it. And at one point, I looked at the OCHA, the Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the division of UN, and I looked at their tweets just out of curiosity, and you know, I counted the number of times they tweeted anything about Fou and Kafraya, and compared that to Madaya, and the difference was astounding. So the situation in Madaya was that in October 2015, UN and Red Cross and I think Red Crescent agencies took in food and aid into Madaya. That's October 2015, and the ICRC spokesperson said the people of Madaya had enough aid to last for several months. Come January 2016, suddenly everybody was saying Madaya is starving, and all the blame was put on the Syrian government. And at the same time, when, as I mentioned, Fou and Kafraya were severely besieged, nobody was talking about them. So it was clearly a campaign to, again, vilify the Syrian government. And by the way, when RT journalist Murad Gazdiev went into Madaya with an aid shipment, might have been later in January or early February, he talked with the people, and they were saying the rebels or the terrorists have taken the food. There is food, but we don't have access to it. And this is the same situation that played out in Aleppo.
So I'd say you're like basically talking about unbalanced reporting, but to put it mildly. But I mean, I'm wondering, I feel like I have to ask you this just for the sake of some skeptical listeners, but if you could just sort of establish the integrity of your own reporting in the sense, like, okay, when you talk to these people, exactly, like, what are you asking them? And are you being directed by Syrian government officials and they're saying, oh, you can talk to those people over there, but don't talk to those people over there, that kind of thing? I mean, how, you know, can we trust that you're getting a fairly... a fair appraisal of what the mood is? Maybe you're not, there are the Assad critics that you're just not able to get to or not, you know.
Well, I mean, to some extent that's true in that I haven't gone to, say, areas occupied by al-Nusra where the so-called FSA, the Free Syrian Army, are, and other so-called rebels that the West still insists on calling moderates, even though they have committed massacres from the very early, you know, months of 2011. I haven't talked with these so-called rebels. And so in that sense, people could accuse me of bias. But the reason I haven't talked with these so-called rebels is because I don't feel the need to validate them. You know, the majority of them are outsiders and are funded by the very states that are waging and that have premeditated this war on Syria: Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the West, the NATO alliance, Turkey. And so, no, I haven't spoken with those. However, I have met with the Minister of Reconciliation and with internal opposition parties who are not armed and not funded by the West. And other than that, you know, in my meetings with Syrians, by and large, what I try to convey, yes, I've met with political and religious figures in Syria, in the government, but most of the reports I've written have been to take the testimonies of people from areas where they've been suffering. So, for example, I went to Homs many times. I went to Homs in June 2014, about, I think it was 1 month, if I remember correctly, after the rebels that were in Homs in the old city had been taken out in a deal that saw them transported elsewhere to Syria in order to bring peace to the old city. And I interviewed, and in fact, at that point, I was with a dear friend who was translating for me. But I also speak Arabic, so the point of having a translator was to ensure that I had, you know, 100% accuracy, but I could understand what was being said. And so I was speaking with this family and taking their testimony, what was life like under the so-called rebels. And obviously what they were saying contradicted what, you know, corporate media was saying. And they were saying the same kind of things that people in Madaya, where I have not gone, or people in Aleppo, where I have gone, were saying, and that is, you know, they were being terrorized, and the so-called rebels had taken their food. I also spoke with somebody who knew the Jesuit priest, Father Franz van der Loot, in the old city of Homs. And he gave his account of how this priest was assassinated by one of these rebels. And so, you know, I was with this person that was translating for me, and offhand, I don't remember if there was somebody from the Ministry of Information with me. But even in instances when there has been somebody from the Ministry of Information with me, they haven't hindered my interactions with Syrians. For example, in Aleppo, there was somebody, and she sat in the side of the room, you know, and I was asking questions to, say, the doctors from the Aleppo Medical Association, which our media never deigned to interview, or when I was meeting with people in hospitals, you know. So at times there have been people from the Ministry of Information present, but that hasn't hindered my interactions. And my interactions in Damascus, I go on my own. I meet, you know, I talk with people in the markets or wherever I happen to encounter them. And maybe I'm being watched from a distance, I couldn't say. And it doesn't matter because I have one-on-one interactions with people. And, you know, in certain instances, I've video recorded them, or otherwise I've just written about what they have to say. So, you know, people can take what I write and the recordings that I have with whatever grains of salt they wish. But the point is, the Western media, BBC, CBC, whatever, that goes to Syria, they pointedly don't try to take the testimonies of people who are overtly supportive of the government or who point out the real problem in Syria is this NATO war on Syria. They phrase it differently. They say the terrorists that Erdogan has sent us, for example. And I know this, for example, one of the four times I was in Aleppo was in, I was there twice in November, and the first trip in November, I actually joined a delegation that was organized by an Aleppo member of parliament, and this delegation comprised, I believe it was 13 other media workers, journalists, photographers, including New York Times, LA Times, and an independent woman who's for years been writing propaganda against Syria, but she joined the delegation as well. And that was the only time that that I was in some sort of government-minded delegation. But even then, you know, what we saw, so for example, on November 3rd, there was an onslaught of terrorist bombings, Grad missiles, gas canister and water heater bombs, explosive bullets, et cetera, that in the end killed 18 civilians and wounded over 200. And we happened to be at one of the main hospitals when victims were coming in. So we all saw the same thing, but people reported it in different ways. The New York Times, Anne Bernard, reported it, but then she tagged, kind of balanced it out by reporting claims based on the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in the UK and which has no people on the ground. They have unnamed activists on the ground. Anyway, she had to qualify the actual genuine suffering of people of Aleppo by reporting something based on the SOHR, which may or may not have had any sort of validity. And she also implied that what happened on November 3rd was random, when in fact, talking with the people, and she was there, she heard the cries of the people saying, this is happening to us every day. So this is an example of even when corporate media has access to these people, they aren't replying truthfully, you know. So and what they try to do is to say, well, independents who go there aren't able to report the whole truth. And that, in my opinion, is not the truth. I've never been hindered by the presence of anybody from the government with me.
We'll return to our conversation with independent journalist Eva Bartlett in a couple of minutes. But first, I wanted to remind our listeners that coming up in a few weeks, CKUW 95.9 FM, the community radio station which hosts the original broadcast of this program, is calling on the financial support of our loyal audiences. On the Global Research NewsHour, we delve into tough subjects that other programs and other media won't touch. If you're a regular listener, you probably agree that dissident perspectives such as those from Michelle Chosadovsky, Mahdi Nazemroya, Guy McPherson, Ava Golinger, Corey Morningstar, Dmitry Orlov, Pepe Escobar, Stephen Lendman, Eve Engler, Abayomi Azikiwe, Ellen Brown, and others deserve more exposure than they typically get from mainstream or even a lot of alternative media. That's why I'm asking for your help in supporting CKUW, the radio station which has kept the Global Research NewsHour a presence on the local airwaves and on the internet through podcasts. Independent media have a critical role in dismantling the mainstream media propaganda narratives which were used to justify the US-NATO military interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and now possibly wider conflicts encompassing Russia, Iran, and China. Indie media is needed to provide necessary critiques of globalization and neoliberal trade agreements that the corporate media ignores. CKUW does not accept paid ads, none whatsoever. We don't depend on corporate advertising and the elite entrenched interests which invariably distort content. We receive funding in part from the University of Winnipeg Student Union. Otherwise, we are 100% dependent on the generosity of listeners like yourself to finance the various fees, new equipment, staff salaries, and other operating costs which make it possible for the unique and informed viewpoints you hear on this program to reach the ears of the public. On behalf of the station, I encourage you to assess how important independent media is to you and donate what you can to this station or to any affiliate station which may bring our program to your radio. Winnipeg listeners are encouraged to listen to CKUW 95.9 FM between February 10th and February 17th. The Global Research NewsHour airs February 17th at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. You may also donate online at fundrive.ckuw.ca. Please note that we cannot authorize tax receipts for listeners outside Canada or guarantee incentives for listeners living abroad. Thank you in advance for your support. It is greatly appreciated. Now, please stay tuned for more of our conversation with Eva Bartlett. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Maybe we should talk a little bit more, since Aleppo has been so much in the news lately. And I mean, at the same time that I understand there have been celebrations of the liberation of Aleppo on the ground, and I could think that this is something like Vanessa Beely and others could have reported on. But we've gotten in the Western presses that, oh, you know, save Aleppo, it's a terrible disaster. And I mean, I keep getting this, you know, Amnesty International face on my feed. But given your own experiences, did you feel that you or any of the people around you were concerned about the Russian and Syrian onslaught?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is another instance where the media is manufacturing stories about Russian bombings. Of course, Russia is present in Syria at the invitation of the Syrian government, in contrast to the illegal presence of the American-led coalition that is supposedly fighting ISIS, but is accidentally dropping supplies to ISIS and allowing them to take over Syrian army positions and the city of Palmyra, as we remember. But yeah, there have been times close calls in various parts of Syria, not just Aleppo. I've been sniped at twice. And in Aleppo, you know, getting there was dangerous. When I first went in July, the access point was a road called that went through the district of Ramusi. And on either side of the road at points, there, on one side and then either side, there was a sand embankment meant to shield from sniper fire, and also an embankment of barrels and various objects also meant to shield from sniper fire from so-called rebels that were based in Sheikh Saeed just a few hundred meters beyond. So there was that, you know, the risk of being sniped at constantly. And this, I have to point out, was, you know, okay, so I had that risk a couple of times, but this is something that Syrians were enduring, you know, all the time, because this was the only access road into Aleppo. And I just want to pause here and make this point that since the so-called rebels took over pockets of Aleppo in I think it was mid-2012, there have been periods where the 1.5 million people of greater Aleppo that the corporate media just totally disappeared. They never talked about these people. There were periods when these people were under siege and had, you know, no access to the outside world. And that meant no access to fresh food, vegetables, etc. And our media wouldn't talk about this. And, you know, so it would be, for example, this particular road going through Ramusi was cut off by the so-called rebels, and the population of greater Aleppo was under siege. So I'll make that point. In August, I entered Aleppo by the north along a road called Castello. And this is because, in fact, the Ramusi road had been closed due to heavy so-called rebel shelling and you know, attacks on Ramusi. And so it was closed. That road was closed because it was too dangerous to travel on. The Castello road had just been opened because the Syrian army and allies, regional allies, had just liberated that area, the areas around it. And so this is now the only road into Aleppo. And it was also dangerous because rebel or mercenary factions to the, I think it was the west, were shelling the road. So when we were leaving, there was great, like, they were mortaring the road. It was quite possible that we would have been hit. And within Aleppo itself, you know, I mentioned on a daily basis, these militant factions, these mercenaries, these terrorists, you know, invading the country, were shelling the city, and they weren't just shelling military positions. You'd think that's what they'd be doing, but just as in Damascus with the mortars that terrorists fire from Jobar or Ghouta district east of Damascus, in Aleppo also, these mercenaries were targeting parks and hospitals and universities, or the University of Aleppo, and schools and, you know, streets, public places, public spaces. And so there was always that possibility of getting hit by one of their gas canister bombs, water heater bombs. There was an explosion roughly 500 meters away. I don't know what kind of bomb it was, and I'm not sure the extent of the damage that day in July. And also an explosive bullet landed something 10, 15 meters away. So, you know, actually the day after I left, a good friend's mother was killed by one of these explosive bullets. And when I talked with the Aleppo, what's the name? Not coroner. Head of forensics there, he said that 11,000 civilians had been killed by these bombings over the past 4 or 5 years. So, you know, again, with all these fake crocodile tears for Save Aleppo and these Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch reports and tweets, they actually didn't care about the people of Greater Aleppo. They, you know, I don't remember any condemnation from them or any outrage from the United Nations about what was happening to the people of Aleppo. And I visited hospitals in Aleppo where you can find, you know, children and adults who are maimed, limbs missing, face mutilated by these attacks. You know, so you hit on a good point when you talked about these campaigns from Amnesty or, you know, Amnesty and Human Rights Watch are tied to the U.S. government. And Ken Roth, who is the director of Human Rights Watch, has repeatedly tweeted misinformation on Syria, including tweeting footage from Gaza and saying this is Aleppo and the destruction was from, you know, Assad's barrel bombs or Russian bombing, when it was clearly eastern Gaza, a district I know very well, Shijai. And, you know, he has an agenda, and that is to support the NATO agenda, which is to topple Assad and impose a puppet government in Syria. And yet, you know, these groups, whether the Human Rights Watch, Avaz, or so-called anti-war groups like Code Pink.
There's also Médecins Sans Frontières.
Absolutely. They're engaging in war propaganda. Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, was complicit in the lies about a hospital. It was actually an improvised field hospital, to my knowledge, in the Sukari district of eastern Aleppo. And earlier in, I think it was April or so, 2016, MSF came out with a report saying that due to aerial bombings from either Syria or Russian, the hospital was, quote-unquote, reduced to rubble. So, you know, reduced to rubble doesn't mean it was attacked lightly. It means it was completely leveled. And yet, some months later, The Guardian was producing reports saying this particular hospital was treating so-called victims of chemical weapons attacks. And this has been another theme over the years, to allege and accuse the Syrian government of chemical weapons attacks. And every time it's been the so-called rebels. And in this instance, The Guardian was saying, you know, chlorine attacks or something like that. And in fact, that was interesting because the rebels, the terrorists, possessed the only chlorine factory in Aleppo. But anyway, this particular hospital still stands. And there were, first we had only the imagery, the satellite imagery provided by the Russian Ministry of Defense, which showed what looked to be the hospital in the same physical state as it was in October 2015. So, you know, the accusation of reduced to rubble was clearly false. And more recently, colleagues of mine were in eastern Aleppo, and they went to that specific field hospital, and they were inside it. So it's intact, and it was operational as of, I believe it was July 2016. So, you know, Médecins Sans Frontières doesn't have staff on the ground. They, like the UN, like all the media, are relying on unnamed activists for their information, or they're relying on completely and overtly biased Al-Qaeda-affiliated white helmets, so-called Syrian civil defense.
Effectively, there have been these campaigns against you, and I know that you, to a lot of people, you came under fire after that presentation at the UN. They took a couple of comments that I kind of struck me as being just almost as asides, and like they just jumped on them and you used them as to smear everything else that you've documented, photographed, interviews, all of that. Is we should just ignore it because of a couple of comments in passing that you made. Would you like to address that in any way?
Absolutely. Thank you. It's interesting that Snopes, Channel 4 UK, which has been one of the heaviest war propagandists in terms of, you know, Western British media, and a few others have written or created these smear campaigns against me. First of all, the articles that they've written don't just address minute aspects of what I said, but they also, you know, tag in things like conspiracy theorist or other things totally meant to discredit my person. And they use strawman arguments wherein they take out of context or they mix things that I've said to confuse people. So I will admit that I could have phrased things better with regard to the issue of children being used in media manipulation. I still stand by the fact that children are being used in media manipulation, and we shouldn't be surprised because, you know, this has happened in other instances, and even in December, Egypt arrested a group of people who were staging what was to be Aleppo videos, and they had a little girl dressed in white with what looked to be blood but had to be paint. and the Egyptian authorities arrested these people. So, you know, this could have been yet another video produced to say this is Aleppo under Assad or Russian bombing. The thing that I mentioned, a girl who looks to be appearing in a few different situations, I cannot definitively prove that. However, it seems quite possible that she's appeared in at least two different videos, but I can't prove that. I am, however, looking into that, and, you know, I think a forensic video analysis could say whether or not this has been the case. But the point being, the videos that that this girl and the videos being produced are produced by either the White Helmets, who are funded with $100 million from the West, and, as I mentioned, work only in Al-Qaeda areas, and were founded by a British ex-military officer, or they're being produced by the Aleppo Media Center, which is also funded by the West and is not, you know, neutral and impartial. But the other point about that whole conference, so I could have phrased things better, I admit, you know, but I still maintain that there's the possibility, and certainly media manipulation is occurring. One other point I want to make about the White Helmets very quickly. I wasn't aware of this whole mannequin challenge thing, but somebody, one of the White Helmets members, submitted one of their own videos to this mannequin challenge, in which I guess people are supposed to act as if they're mannequins. And it just shows, this video, I don't believe, was crafted to participate in the mannequin challenge video, but it does show that the White Helmets videos are very clearly staged. And in fact, recently, one former White Helmets member came out and admitted that he joined thinking that he was joining what they call civil defense, and at some point he was asked to start acting in some of their productions, and he was saying, why do we need to act? And they said, because we won't get the money from our funders in, you know, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Europe. And he repeated this a couple of times, that he and several others were asking, why do we have to act? And the same answer was that, you know, it's all about getting our money. And he also made a mention of children being in some of these videos, and children were acting. So, I mean, you know, we have to take his testimony also with a grain of salt. Was he being genuine or not in it? But this testimony actually is in a video produced by Anna News, who were on the ground in East Aleppo, and they were at the headquarters of the White Helmets. It's a quite interesting video. But back to the whole UN thing. So these smear campaign articles focused only on the Aya comment, the girl, and the Quds Hospital. Now, the Quds Hospital, I was only wrong in saying that it hadn't been attacked, because I can't prove that it hasn't been attacked. But what I was correct in general in saying is that, you know, it hasn't been reduced to rubble, and that was the claim of the media, and that was the claim of NSF. Now, these articles did not address any of the other issues that I made, any other points I made in the, say, 25, 30-minute long UN press conference, or the points made by my colleagues on the panel, some of whom have been to Syria. You know, and the points also were about what I've said just in our interview about the life for the 1.5 million-plus people in Aleppo, the attacks, and other areas of Syria, which I spoke of. And clearly, the point that they focused on, this girl and the Quds Hospital, it was clearly meant just to be defamatory and discredit me. And it may have worked, but it's interesting, if you look at the comments on Channel 4, people aren't buying their propaganda. A lot of the comments are saying, look, we know that you're lying. With Snopes, their article was full of these straw men arguments, and also personal attacks, including that conspiracy theorist comment, and completely conflating things. I'm going to be issuing a rebuttal. I'm working on it. I've been quite busy, but I'm going to be issuing a rebuttal, kind of looking at both the Snopes and Channel 4 arguments, and showing, you know, where their fallacies are. And Snopes itself, I mean, there's some interesting articles out about Snopes and their own compromised, you know, issues and engagements right now. They're said to be a fact-checking site, and yet they, in fact, in an earlier article referencing some of Vanessa Beely's work on 21st Century Wire with regards to the White Helmets, Snopes completely dismissed the fact that White Helmets operate in Al-Qaeda areas and operate with terrorists and include members of terrorist factions. So Snopes seems to have their own agenda. So, you know, their attack piece on me is itself not credible.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it seems, yeah, there's more to fact-checking than simply, you know, going to one of these sorts of sites. And I would just say to our listeners that, you know, You don't necessarily have to agree with Ava Bartlett, but I think that before you judge her, you should at least check out her reporting. Read the reports that on her site, ingaza.wordpress.com, and judge them on their merits. Please don't dismiss her because she because of a hit piece on Snopes or because she published something on a so-called fake news site called by certainly the usual suspects. Ava, I think we've got to wrap up now. Is there anything else you'd like to say, either about the tour or anything else we've touched on before we go?
Yeah, actually, thanks for mentioning that. Colleagues and, anti-war activists are organizing for me to give some talks in Hamilton on the 24th and 5th, in Ottawa on the 27th, and Montreal on the 28th. And I think that a member of Global Research may be on one of the panels, and also perhaps Stephen Gowans may be on one of the panels. I hope so. I highly, aside from what I've reported, I highly recommend that listeners look at the writings of Stephen Gowans. It's incredibly coherent and articulate and gives a lot of historical context that people need to understand how events have come about in Syria. I'd also really encourage people to look for the writings of Tim Anderson and his book on Syria. Again, he's been in Syria. He's highly articulate and has researched very well. And, with regard to Aleppo, I just say, of course, please look at Syrian reporters, because there are reporters who do report in English. Muhammad Ali reports for Press TV, Ala Ibrahim as well. And there have been other independent people who have gone to Aleppo, particularly during its liberation, Vanessa Bealey, Jan Oberg, Andrew Ashdown. So there's a number of sources. What I do, I don't look at one source. Obviously, I cross-reference, and people do not have to believe everything I'm saying. Look at other sources, and you'll find a lot of correlations and corroborations. Thanks very much for having me on and giving me this time to talk a little bit about Syria.
Well, thank you very much.
We've been joined by Eva Bartlett. She is an independent writer, journalist, and rights activist. Her website is ingaza.wordpress.com.
To shed further light on the Syrian crisis, I'm joined by the aforementioned Stephen Gowans. He writes on a number of subjects, is author of the popular blog What's Left, and he is the author of the soon-to-be-released book Washington's Long War on Syria. He joins us from Ottawa. Thank you once again for joining us, Stephen Gowans.
Thank you, Michael.
I'm going to start with a quote from an article written by Ashley Smith of the International Socialist Organization for Counterpunch, which I think encapsulates a lot of the thinking from the anti-imperialist left on Syria. This is the quote: "A genuine internationalist left must stand with Syria's popular resistance to Assad, which began as a non-violent uprising against the dictatorship and against intervention by American and Russian imperialism, as well as by the region's main powers. How could opponents of U.S. imperialism end up supporting a dictator, one who has been known to collaborate with the U.S. in torturing war on terror prisoners in the CIA's extraordinary rendition program?" Unquote. So, Stephen, maybe you could start by correcting the record on this popular resistance and its origins, it seems, in Daraa in 2011. What evidence is there that this revolution from its beginnings was not what people like Ashley Smith are leading us to believe?
I've often heard people talk about this as a popular, nonviolent uprising. And I went back to press coverage in the months and weeks immediately following this so-called uprising to look at what was going on, to look at what the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time magazine were saying. And what I discovered was that in the weeks and months preceding that riot, those newspapers and those media organizations were saying, look, there's an uprising throughout the Arab world, but nothing's happening in Syria. Why is nothing happening in Syria? There was a Facebook page that was created at the beginning of 2011 in Syria called the Syrian Revolution, and it called for days of rage demonstrations to be held early in the year. Those demonstrations came off, but barely anyone attended them. They fizzled. And those people who did go to the demonstrations usually chanted slogans that pertained to Gaddafi, who at the time was kind of locked into a war with what we now know were Islamists. And so the Time reporters and the New York Times reporters started scratching their heads and looking into the reasons why it was that there was little revolutionary distemper in Syria where there seemed to be elsewhere in the Arab world. And what they discovered was that the Syrian government had a considerable amount of popular support. So they said, you know, Assad is very popular, and even his critics concede that. He's endeared himself to the public. He espouses positions that the public support. And there's little chance, according to Syrians, that there's going to be any uprising in Syria. Well, then we did have riots or a series of riots that begin about March 17th in the town of Deraa. And if you look at the reports in March 17th, March 18th, coming from mainline Western newspapers about what was going on, they say U.S. officials have acknowledged that this was, or these were violent riots. So there were men seen at the riots who were bearing arms. Buildings were burned down. Governor's office was burned down. The Ba'ath Party headquarters was burned down. Two cell phone company buildings were burned down. Vehicles were burned. There were clashes with police. These were riots involving a few hundred people. It wasn't a mass uprising of thousands or tens of thousands of people. And it wasn't nonviolent. This is even acknowledged by U.S. officials. The established or correspondent Robert Fisk, who's well known, Robert Fisk also wrote of seeing videos taken at these demonstrations that showed people bearing arms and pistols. So the uprising wasn't popular because it involved only hundreds of people. The demands weren't for Assad to step down. The demands related to the release of political prisoners and an end to wartime measures. And the New York Times and Time soon reported that the riots, there became a series of riots that broke out, and the riots had Islamist content. At no point can you read in any of these Western media accounts of anyone talking about, fundamental changes to the political and economic system.
So I'm wondering if there was a trigger event that made 2011 the time for this to happen. Was it having to do with pipelines? Was it the, something that, maybe developments around come with regard to Russia? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, some people, or many people, often think that the United States is only interested in ousting the Syrian government and forcing Assad to step down from 2011. But as Patrick Coburn, the Middle East correspondent, has pointed out, the United States has long wanted to get rid of Assad. They wanted to get rid of Assad's father, who was his predecessor as president. In 2001, you may recall that U.S. General Wesley Clark told Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman that the Pentagon had drawn up plans to invade seven countries, including Iraq, Libya, and Syria. 2002, Syria was added to the Bush administration's Axis of Evil regime change hit list. And Washington said, Syria was developing weapons of mass destruction in the same way Iraq was supposed to have done, and that it was supporting terrorism. Then in 2005, the U.S. Congressional Research Service reported that the U.S. government was actively weighing regime change in Syria. And they said the impetus for pursuing regime change was to sweep away an impediment to the achievement of U.S. goals in the Middle East related to strengthening Israel, because the Syrian government is an implacable opponent of Israel, consolidating U.S. domination of Iraq, because Syria was opposed to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and also fostering open market and free enterprise economies. If you look at U.S. Documents, say from the Congressional Research Service or from the State Department, you'll see lots of complaints about Syrian economic policy. Syrian economic policy, or Syria is often being branded as a socialist country in the United States. Some people would say, well, we don't really believe it's socialist. Marxists might say that. But it's clear that the U.S. government believes that Syria has pursued socialist policies. 2007, the Muslim Brotherhood teamed up with the former Syrian vice president to found something called the National Salvation Front. The National Salvation Front frequently met with the U.S. State Department and the U.S. National Security Council and had two meetings at the White House. They're also receiving funding from the Middle East, or the U.S. government-funded Middle East Partnership Initiative, and it had been reported in the Washington Post that the opposition to the secular Arab nationalist government in Syria had been receiving funding from the United States since at least 2005. So what were the reasons? Why did the United States want to ally with this opposition? I should also mention that in 2005, the Congressional Research Service said that the United States had actually intended to invade Syria immediately following its invasion of Iraq, but it discovered that its hands were full with the occupation of Iraq, its resources were stretched too thin, and that it had to abandon its plans to actually invade Syria and instead pursue this kind of regime change policy in which they would ally with Islamists to overthrow the secular Arab nationalist government. So what's the impetus? The impetus is to do in Syria exactly what was done in Iraq, which is to, quote, de-ba'athify the country, which is essentially remove the secular Arab nationalist influence from Syria, as it was done from Iraq, and to prevent it from ever coming back. If Assad was forced to step down, we should ask the question, why is it that the United States is so interested in having Assad step down? It's not really Assad that they want to step down. Who they want to step down are secular Arab nationalists who pursue policies which are at odds with kind of the Wall Street-friendly economic policies that the United States favors in the world. Also, the United States, this is quite clear if you read any U.S. strategy documents, that the United States regards itself as the self-appointed leader of a global political and economic order. The secular Arab nationalists in Washington have made it quite clear that they now have no intention of falling in behind Washington as leader of a global economy, that they prize their independence, they prize their economic sovereignty, and they don't intend to, as Assad once put it, make Syrians work for the benefit of U.S. corporations and U.S. banks and investors.
Mm. I want to thank you for enlightening us in this regard, Stephen. And your book is coming out when exactly?
It will be released in April, April 17th, I believe.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stephen Gowans is the author of the soon-to-be-released book Washington's Long War on Syria and of the popular blog What's Left, which can be found at gowans.wordpress.com. He joined us from Ottawa.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Next week, on the occasion of the inauguration of incoming President Donald Trump, we'll have a special program dedicated to Trump and the deep state. We hope you'll tune in. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Bye for now.